This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.
Welcome to the first episode of our Furlough and Beyond podcast series. As global pandemic recovery begins, we will look at some of the key issues that businesses face as they roll out their return to work plans. In this episode, Emma Bartlett and Anisha Vyas explore the key steps to working safely and how businesses will need to translate government guidance into specific actions.
Thank you, Chantel. Thank you for joining our podcast. My name is Emma Bartlett and I'm a partner in our employment team. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Anisha Vyas, an associate in our team. Hi, Anisha. How are you?
Hi, Emma. I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you. So today we will be looking at frequently asked questions about returning to work in the current circumstances. While the government currently advises that we should all still work from home where possible, more workplaces are beginning to open or are planning to return to work. And many employees are going to have some concerns about returning, and we're going to look at the issues employees may face. The government has produced 8 guidance notes on working safely during coronavirus in different types of work environment, and they set out detailed steps and recommendations for employers to take. Whilst the guidance does not have legal status, it is likely to be seen as the minimum steps an employer should take to be compliant in law. Communication and reassurance will be key to a successful reopening of the workplace. The guidance sets out steps employers must work through to reduce workplace risks and focuses on 5 key points. Firstly, work from home if possible, but those who cannot and whose workplace has not been told to close should go to work. Number 2, carry out a COVID-19 risk assessment in consultation with workers or trade unions to establish what guidelines to put in place. If possible, publish the results on your website, and businesses with more than 50 employees are expected to do this. Number 3, maintain social distancing where possible by redesigning workplaces, such as staggering start times, creating one-way walkthroughs, opening more exits and entrances, and changing seating layouts. Number 4, manage transmission risks where social distancing is not possible. For example, again, by staggering start times, putting barriers in shared spaces, or having fixed teams, minimising the number of people in contact with each other. And number 5, reinforcing cleaning processes, paying close attention to high contact objects such as door handles and keyboards, and providing hand washing facilities or hand sanitizers at entry and exit points. So Anisha, this is all about health and safety really. Can you summarise what health and safety obligations employers will owe to their staff to keep safe during COVID-19?
Yes, so in addition to following the guidance, employers have statutory and common law duties to provide a safe place of work, and they need to consider the risks workers face and do everything reasonably practical to minimise those risks. So this is likely to involve a few key things, such as consultation with workers. So employers need to listen and talk to workers about the work that they do and how any risks will be managed. It's important to remember that it's the people doing the work who are often best placed to understand the risks and have a view on how to work safely. Employers must also consult with the health and safety representative selected by a recognised trade union if there is one, or if there isn't one, a representative chosen by the workers or the workers themselves about the health and safety aspects of reopening. Secondly, employers should think about carrying out suitable risk assessments to identify the risks. And risk assessments should consider different groups of workers, for example, vulnerable workers who are likely to require additional measures. So the Health and Safety Executive has provided general guidance, which employers should look at. And this guidance sets out how to conduct a risk assessment, which will need to be adapted using appropriate workplace guidance for the employee's particular environment. Then once the risk assessments have been completed, employers should take steps to reduce the risks identified. Whilst employers will not be able to eliminate the risks altogether, they must take all reasonable practical steps to minimise those risks. While significant findings from risk assessments should always be written down if there are more than 5 members of staff, it's now worth noting that the guidance also recommends that COVID-19 risk assessments should be published on an employer's website. So employers with more than 50 employees are expected to do this.
And can an employee refuse to return to work because of COVID-19?
So that's a really interesting point, and it's one which many employers will now have to face. So the existing health and safety legislation protects employees against detriment, such as non-payment of wages or dismissal if they refuse to attend work because of a reasonable belief that attending work would put them in serious and imminent danger. If employers have taken all reasonable steps to assess the risks at work and have addressed these in line with the government guidelines, then this should be sufficient in relation to the workplace itself, and it's likely that any fear of imminent and serious danger is not reasonable on the part of the employees. I think in the short term, at least, however, taking disciplinary action against genuinely fearful employees may not be the best course of action. So Emma, do you think this protection, which I've just outlined, would extend to travelling to and from work?
Normally, there are no specific statutory responsibilities on employers for an employee's journey to work, as distinct from travel in the course of their employment. But the current situation is unusual. The existing provisions, which you've just discussed, set out they may extend to travel to and from work if the employee reasonably believes that a commute would place them in serious or imminent danger. As is often the case, this will be very fact specific. The current government guidance is to avoid public transport where possible, and for many, this makes it extremely difficult to get to work. Employers should consult and speak to staff about their concerns and what steps the employer could take to meet these concerns. And this may involve adjusting hours, providing additional parking, and taking steps to enable more cycling. But discussing employees' concerns and taking steps to address them will hopefully resolve most issues. There's two new categories of staff that the government has outlined in their guidance. One is extremely clinically vulnerable. Can you outline what additional steps employers should be taking in relation to that group of employees?
Yeah, sure. So the extremely clinically vulnerable category includes organ transplant recipients, people with certain cancers, those with severe respiratory conditions, and pregnant women with significant heart disease. So it's really likely that individuals in this category will be disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act 2010, which gives them additional protection. And the current guidance is that people within this category should stay at home and shield. It would not be appropriate, therefore, to insist on such a worker returning to work, and this may lead to potential claims under health and safety legislation and discrimination. The extremely clinically vulnerable should therefore work from home if possible, and if that's not possible, another option might be furlough if they have already been furloughed and the furlough scheme is available in respect of them.
And what about the second category, clinically vulnerable?
Many of those in the clinically vulnerable category, which includes those with underlying health conditions who are advised to get the flu jab annually, the over 70s and pregnant women, may also be disabled under the Equality Act. Although I should note that that's quite unlikely to apply to those who are simply pregnant or over 70 with no other issues. However, if any workers are disabled under the Equality Act, they will enjoy special protection under that legislation, and this would include a duty on the employer to make reasonable adjustments. The clinically vulnerable have not been advised to shield, but there is recognition that anyone who is clinically vulnerable may be at greater risk. So employers will need to conduct a risk assessment and may need some medical guidance on what the safest role is for these individuals.
Can an employee insist on not returning because they live with an extremely clinically vulnerable person?
So it's a good question, and it's likely to come up quite a lot. Whilst in the short term it may be practical to allow this, there is no specific right to insist on it. So consultation with the individual will be key to assess whether there are other steps that could be taken to enable these workers to return, such as isolating in the house. It's, you know, important to remember that it's very fact specific and likely to depend on the individual circumstances at hand. So Emma, I guess pregnant workers need consideration as a group all on their own. So how do you think employers should handle pregnant workers?
Yes, that's correct. In addition to the protections that you've just outlined, pregnant women are protected in law against risks to their health and safety and that of their unborn child, as well as against unfavourable treatment because of their pregnancy. So unless they have a heart condition, pregnant women are not classed as clinically extremely vulnerable, although they would be classed as clinically vulnerable. and under existing provisions, a specific risk assessment must be undertaken in any event for a pregnant employee. And if no safe work can be identified, she's entitled to suspension on full pay. Unfortunately, this is a developing situation and government guidance is developing with it. But currently the guidance is that pregnant women should take particular care to adhere to social distancing measures, but subject to risk assessments flagged above, they can travel to workplaces and work. Anisha, what if an employee does not want to return to work though because of childcare issues?
In this type of situation, during the period of the furlough scheme, the government guidance provides that an employer is permitted to place an employee who is unable to work because of caring responsibilities resulting from the pandemic on furlough. Now, in light of the recent changes to the furlough scheme, it's worth bearing in mind that only those employees who were previously furloughed prior to the 10th of June can now be furloughed going forward. Additionally, employees are entitled to reasonable time off for dependent leave in some circumstances. There's no obligation on an employer to pay the employee for this time off, and what is reasonable is not set out. In the short term, I think employers are likely to want to take a sympathetic approach to requests for time off. An employee also has an entitlement to take unpaid parental leave of up to 18 weeks at any time until the child is 18, so it's also worth noting that. It's also worth just bearing in mind that working arrangements, for example, in relation to attending work, which place a specified or a specific group, such as women, at a particular disadvantage, will be indirectly discriminatory. This will be unlawful unless it can be justified as a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. As with many aspects of return to work, the employer will need to discuss individual circumstances fully and openly with their employees. If they are struggling with childcare issues. If the furlough scheme is ended or it isn't available for particular staff due to the scheme being closed to new entrants, the employer could consider other options that may be available.
Do you think a refusal to work might amount to whistleblowing?
So there are various conditions and criteria which need to be met before a disclosure can amount to a protected disclosure for the purposes of whistleblowing. A refusal to work or complaints about the working environment may amount to a protected disclosure depending on the circumstances and facts. Whilst it's not always clear whether a concern raised amounts to a protected disclosure, I think in these circumstances it is sensible to assume that a complaint may be a valid disclosure and ensure that the complainant is not subject to any detrimental treatment in order to limit potential exposure or claims for the employer.
That makes sense. And what about one of the things that's been in the press recently is where employers might want to temperature check staff. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think this is a question which is likely to come up a lot. Whilst the government guidance does not include temperature checking or testing as a step to consider, many employers are considering these extra precautions. I think we just need to be mindful of data protection requirements here, and the Information Commissioner's Office has released data protection guidance on this particular issue, making it clear that data protection law does not prevent employers from taking the necessary steps to keep their staff safe, and such additional steps may help reassure staff that it is safe to return. Employers can process some health information for the purposes of complying with health and safety duties, but this needs to be both necessary and proportionate, and data must be handled responsibly and with care. I therefore think it's really important worth noting that if you are considering undertaking testing, then you should conduct a data protection impact assessment, focusing on the new areas of risk and taking into account the ICO guidance on workplace testing.
Thank you. And do employers need to provide PPE?
An employer's risk assessment should highlight the steps that they need to take to minimise the risks of transmission at work. The current government guidance emphasises managing the risk through social distancing, hygiene, screens and fixed teams rather than PPE in the workplace. In an office environment, it's extremely unlikely that PPE would be necessary. However, if some members of staff feel more comfortable wearing face coverings, then they can do so, but this is not a substitute for the other methods of reducing the risks. It's also worth making the point that PPE supplies should not be depleted where their use has not been recommended in a risk assessment.
There's obviously much more we could discuss on returning to work, but I've got my last question now for you. What if someone who has returned to work then tests positive for COVID-19?
Yes, that's a good question. And if it's suspected that the exposure to COVID-19 happened in the workplace, this is now reportable under the Reporting of Injuries, Diseases and Dangerous Occurrences Regulations 2013. In terms of notifying colleagues, employers have to bear in mind that they have a duty of confidentiality and privacy obligations towards the ill member of staff. They also have a duty of care to other employees. So colleagues will need to be warned that they've been in contact with someone who has now tested positive. And if it's not realistic to keep the ill employee's identity anonymous, employers should reveal no more information than is absolutely necessary.
Thank you, Anisha. It's something on which we're going to continue advising, I know, for many months to come. But that concludes our first podcast in this series. If you found it helpful, you may be interested in our next podcast, in which we'll be discussing the government's latest guidance on the coronavirus job retention scheme, which will be published and recorded on our website next week. In the meantime, huge thanks to Anisha for her clear and concise responses today.
Thanks, Emma. It's been a pleasure.
I hope the reopening of everyone's workplaces goes well when it happens. Please don't hesitate to contact either myself or Anisha directly if you have any questions.
This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.